Good evening. This is Henry Banks, senior producer and host of WPR's People of Color with Henry Banks show. Joining me tonight are members of the Alabama 35 delegation from Duluth and Superior. The delegation traveled to the southern part of the United States, with the final destination being Montgomery, Alabama, for the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice and the National Legacy Museum from Slavery to Mass Incarceration. 100,000 people from all over the world converged on Montgomery, Alabama for this historic moment. Please join me and my guests, members of the Alabama 35, coming up next on People of Color with Henry Banks after this news. Welcome to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. Thanks for joining us this evening. I am so honored and delighted to have in the studio Carl Huber and Robin Washington, but also on the phone, I'm excited that Heidi Back Hansen is joining us. She was the principal organizer for the Alabama 35 journey to Montgomery, Alabama. Everybody, thank you for being here and taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, Henry.
So, Heidi, I want to start with you. I'm just going to go right to this question. Why was it important for you to put this trip together?
Well, I mean, I think that it was important for our community to be there for a national event. I think that as soon as people started to step forward, but certainly when we met for the soil ceremony back in September, folks were saying that they wanted to go as a group. But it took us a little while to get it together. So, you know, I think that we had to be there. Whoever wanted to be there had to be there. So it was joining the whole country together. And so that's why.
Oh, sure. So yeah. You're one of these tremendous organizers, one of the best I know. I'm going to say that it's very real. One of the best organizers I know. You pulled this together. It seemed like a very short time. You raised all this money to make this trip happen. And the people that were on the bus, it seemed like everything came together. And as you mentioned, the right people at the right time mm-hmm. were on the bus to take yeah. this journey. And I was honored to be on that bus, I have to tell you, because when I realized that I was really going to be on this bus, I knew I was in for a life-changing experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it wouldn't have happened without the help of Jody Broadwell and Treasure Jenkins, too. Jody's much better at the details in a lot of ways than I am. And Treasure is very good at following through and taking care of business as well. So the three of us, really.
Yeah, so we really want to give a shout out to them as well.
Yes, absolutely.
That's for sure. So, okay, so you put the itinerary together, or how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, the itinerary, along with some recommendations by Cheryl, I believe her name is Raytan, who has organized the civil rights journeys for the UMD folks a couple times. And so we met with her early on to talk about the things that they had gone to. So the suggestion of the Kelly Ingram Park was part of her suggestion, but going to Cairo was definitely something I wanted to do, and also going to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis was very important to me as well. You know, going on a bus is never easy, but it seemed like the best way to get the most involvement as far as like being able to go to the different places we wanted to go to and to have as many people as possible to participate, something that we really couldn't have done if we'd done it by airplane or something. So yeah, it was important to have a group together that was committed to being there, you know, and a lot of the elders in the community, you know, trying to do airplanes would not have been easy for them either. So, mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the Cairo excursion first. Okay. You mentioned mm-hmm. that, why did we stop at that location? Why was it important to stop there? And talk a bit about what took place there. And Carl and Robin, you might want to chime in on this too.
Well, for me, I'm from Illinois, first of all, but also in the research that I have done over the last couple decades, the story of what happened in Cairo seemed like an important counterpoint, in a way, to what has happened in Duluth. We both have an industrial past, and we both had a lynching that occurred in our downtown, in the center of town, where 10,000 people showed up to participate in a racial terror incident, white people in particular. So it was, to me, it was a way to examine that more deeply, the idea of what happens to a city when it doesn't acknowledge its history, when it turns away from its history. And Cairo is an example of that. You know, what has happened there is sort of an emptying out in a lot of ways. And, you know, there's nothing there at the site of that lynching of Will James. And the fact that there is nothing there is really difficult to process, you know, not to mention the fact that the entire downtown is gone as well. So, mm-hmm.
So while we were there, though, Heidi, we were mm-hmm. at the corner, all, you know, these 35 or so people, mm-hmm. and a couple cars had gone by. Robin wants to say something before we move forward.
I think, Heidi, you make an understatement when you say there's nothing there for our listeners to
very
truly
true.
Understand. By the way, they may be confused of Cairo. Is actually spelt Cairo as in Cairo, Egypt, but Cairo, Illinois has its own pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
Before I get to the point that I interjected, it's also the place in Huckleberry Finn, a controversial novel mm-hmm. these days, but where Huck and Jim are trying to get, and it's supposed to be the place toward freedom. You gave us a little history on that, that indeed it was a place that African Americans would run to during slavery days and set free in Illinois, as opposed to other places in Illinois. So that actually answered a question that's been bothering me for about 40 years in reading mm-hmm. the book, because I always wondered why Huck and Jim didn't just cross the river. Well, Cairo was the place to go. But But the as you said, it's you know, a shadow of what it was. I kind of estimated at least 3/4 of the structures, the buildings, the mm-hmm. are either abandoned or empty or indeed decaying. And so when you pick this, I don't think you get a bigger contrast.
Wonderful. Yeah, it was wonderful.
A bigger show of really devastation. I suppose not all 100% attributable to the racial discord, but they continue to have it. But mm-hmm. But certainly that didn't help. And and lastly, I would say on that it was a real contrast to Duluth, because here we have a memorial, thanks to you and Henry more than anybody else, I think, that very, very publicly acknowledges our past, however painful it may be. In Cairo, there was nothing except you standing on the corner reading a book.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you can't quite draw a straight line and say this is what happens if you don't acknowledge it, but it was pretty pronounced.
And it was so much sadness. Carl, you were going to say something.
And the structures don't exist. We're on a vacant street corner, an intersection. We're off the bus after several hours of journeying, and it's our first stop. And it's such a stark reality to what we were coming into. And as a father who was accompanying my daughter on this trip, is why I'm along. It started to wrap that, started immersing us into that experience and understanding of the journey we were on.
Mm-hmm. So, Heidi, I want you to take a moment to talk about. So as we're standing on this corner, a couple of cars go by. One car in particular stops and the individuals get out of the car. And we have this marvelous conversation with them.
We're going to share some of that with our listeners so they can kind of get an idea of what that was. Can you talk about that moment when Regina, I believe her name was, and her husband,
Theophilus.
Gave us such a wealth of information?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you're in a town where anything that's happening there is going to be noticed, you know, because there's not much going on there. For me, it was just the fact that they were willing to stop and curious and wanted to find out why we were there. But I think they also knew why we were there in a way. I mean, that location, as I understand it, I didn't hear her say it, but that somebody, she mentioned Will James's nickname right away when she got out of the car. So I wasn't there at that point. I was talking to some other folks. So I, maybe Carl or you can talk a bit more about what she had to say. But to me, it was just the touchstone of this, you know, this is our community. This is, you know, this is what's happened here. This is who we are and how we have experienced what's happened here, you know.
She really supported, though, what you were saying. And you know, you were reading from a book and, of course, your research on it. But here we were in the real life place. This couple, Regina and Theophilus Guerin, were both born and raised in Cairo, still living there against the odds, African-American, and she really echoed what you said. I actually have a bit of the tape of her talking.
Yeah, did you see the photos where all the people were together and they were cheering? Did you all see those? Yeah, that's it right there. Yep, and when you read about it, and the people, they were cheering, and they had brought their children to watch that.
So, Regina, when I look at that picture, it reminds me in many ways of what happened in Duluth. Between 5,000 and 10,000 people in Duluth were at that horrible incident in Duluth.
Yeah.
How many do you expect were at this one?
Probably roughly around that much, because at this point in time, what was the population here? It was, what, about 30,000? During that time, that period of time? So, yeah, 10,000 people wouldn't have been...
Would have been coming, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that, look how large that looks when you look right here. It looks like that's just a massive area, but it's just right there.
Carl, did you want to say anything about that experience? And I know you were up close to Regina and her husband. What did you take out of that?
Well, the powerful thing is that she said hope, and that's why they're there. They stayed because of hope. And as we walked back, I mean, one of the most powerful moments for me is when we had the flowers, and I know, Heidi, you might want to talk more to that, as a memorial at the end to leave there in the memory, just how we circled together as a group for the first time, and she led us in prayer.
And yes, and I love the kids placing the flowers there. That was a beautiful experience.
Yeah, but hope was what rung from the what I heard of. There was a lot was said, but that's why they stay.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're listening to a great conversation here. You're listening to a great conversation I'm having with Carl Huber, Robin Washington, and on the phone, Heidi Mack Hansen. Heidi was the principal organizer, one of them, for the Alabama 35 journey to Montgomery, Alabama, and places in between. This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color. Again, I'm having a conversation with Carl Huber, Robin Washington, and on the phone, wonderful organizer. I can't say that enough. Heidi Back Hansen, she and Jody Broadwell and Treasure Jenkins put together a journey out of this world for 35 people to experience from the Duluth and Superior area. And we are all thankful for that. I want to say right now, thank you for everything you all did.
It was fun. As much as one can say it's fun to do what we did. I mean, it was very emotional, obviously, as well, and emotionally devastating sometimes, but definitely an experience. And it was an experience from the organizer side, too. So it was fun, in that way. It was good. It was meaningful to do.
Absolutely. I'm going to read something from The New Yorker and have the three of you comment on this. From a distance, the lynching memorial appears serene, an architectural feat on a green knoll. But as I enter the dense space, the serenity mutated into uneasiness. By the time the ground gave way so that the monuments hovered above my head, the experience was devastating. So that's when we arrived in Montgomery and witnessed the opening of this incredible memorial. I know we stopped in Memphis, but when we got to Montgomery, I was not expecting to see what I saw. What were you all thinking when I just read this?
Well, I mean, I've watched the videos and the preparations and the design, you know, since they first started talking about it a couple of years, 3 years ago. But definitely experiencing it in person, there's nothing to, I mean, it is, you know, you have people there who want to hear what you have to say about it. And personally, I couldn't say anything. It was devastating is a word, I guess. But yeah, it's a profound experience, and most words can't do it justice in a lot of ways. And I think that part of that experience as a white person is to experience watching other people interacting with it as well. You know, African heritage people confronting that together is just profound.
Mm-hmm. And I just echo as a white male, the phrase that keeps coming through to me is the hauntingly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And as my daughter said to me, Anna, 16, said to me, it's a type of overwhelmed that we all need to be overwhelmed at by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is that you don't have words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Robin? When you went through the memorial itself,
you're quoting the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Leads me to look up a piece that I'm filing for the Marshall Project, www.marshallproject.org, and I'm going to defer to my piece because I've written these words carefully. My editor may change them yet, but first of all, it's called the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And I refer to this as a kinder, gentler name than its colloquial title is the Lynching Memorial.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'm told that Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, when he came up with the idea and he presented it to the town mothers and fathers or leaders in Montgomery, they may not have been too happy with the idea of a lynching memorial. Mm-hmm. So someone suggested peace and justice, and okay, there's the name. So
Right.
But it's more than a single edifice. The total complex includes sculpture gardens, a contemplative memorial square, and a massive structure with rusted steel monoliths engraved with the names hanging from the ceiling. And it just goes on and on. The big square structure, for those familiar with architects, is kind of a Mies van der Rohe looking thing. You enter on one side, say if it's a square, you enter in the bottom left, and you start seeing these pillars, as they call them, or again, they're steel monoliths, rusted steel, various colors, with names on it. The names are engraved with the names of the people who were taken. And the date of their deaths, the incidents, and the name of the county where it occurred. And these immediately become overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Because yes. Mm-hmm. You start seeing so many of them.
Yeah.
And also you notice that there are many that happen at the same day, way more than
multiple.
Yeah, sometimes 20 at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
Families. Mm-hmm. Last names.
That's right, male and female.
Yeah.
You could tell the whole family was taken. As overwhelming as this is, immediately when you get into it, it becomes more and more so the more you walk through. So you round the first corner and you start seeing more. And I attempted to read all the names in all the counties and states. By the time I rounded the third corner, I realized that was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you saw numerous people crying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nearly 5,000 names, too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And that doesn't even take into the sort of weeping wall that represents those who can't be named, you know. So then
right.
That is like a final punch in the gut, really, mm-hmm. When you get to that point.
Right.
And it's like an eternity, you know, of names. One of the things that I did notice, too, is that there were a number of people who, first, they're looking for the county where their ancestors came from and finding those places. The other thing that I saw folks doing is looking for their name, you know, their last name, mm-hmm. Finding people whose last names were like theirs.
I did those very things, both of those. Of course, yeah. Washington is pretty common.
Yeah.
But but I'll tell you, I got a little chill when I saw one saying Arthur Washington, because that's mm-hmm. that's the name of my grandfather. Now, he's fine. He lived to a ripe old age of 86. But still, when you see something like that, and you know it could have been you.
Makes you think.
Been.
Yeah.
So as you all are walking through the memorial, as you're rounding the corners,
mm-hmm.
as you continue to round the corners, what did it make you feel like? Did it make you feel as though you were inside a ship?
That's
what I felt. It felt as though I was going down into the hull of a ship.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. No, I think it, in a way, to me, it feels, I don't know. It's otherworldly in a lot of ways, the way that it's structured. And it's like going into a labyrinth, you know, too. Mm-hmm. For me, a sense of, I mean, it's a religious experience, you know, it's an edifice. I've never seen anything like that. I mean, I have not seen the Holocaust museums and things or memorials at various places. I've never been to them, but I can imagine that, again, it's that sense of scale, you know, innumerability that is especially devastating
Robin, what were you feeling?
It follows the tradition that was started with the Vietnam Memorial Wall, which at that point, and you got to remember in the beginning, that was not well received, and Maya Lin was virtually attacked for how dare they have an Asian person design this, and dare she put a concrete slab or a marble slab as a slate slab instead of some lifelike structure. And in fact, they did put lifelike statues to ameliorate that response. But what people realized after a while was, first of all, I don't know if you could say she invented, but she innovated the idea of the descent. So as you walk into it, you get deeper and deeper into the war. More and more names appear. And then secondly, I don't know if it was her idea or not, but people started using it to leave messages. To those who were departed. So now you take a piece of paper and you put it in there. The same thing happens, by the way, in Israel at the Wailing Wall, although that clearly wasn't created as art. So obviously the EJI people took all this in consideration. And not all public monuments are by any means like this, even though Maya Lin kind of set a new standard. And this one just takes it to a whole
new level.
A whole new level.
New level. Yeah. Carl, you want to say something about that experience as you're walking through there?
Well, it is, like you've said here, you get to the third turn and all the pillars are raised, and all of a sudden you feel lost, even though there's nothing blocking you. And I remember just looking up and thinking, oh, my God, you know, that's the power of that. And it just took me away. I saw a lot of light. It was bright that day, so the colors in the pillars, some of them had reds, like they were almost amber color, the way the light was hitting it, and then in my mind, I was so confused, and but there was nothing blocking me. It was free to walk.
The other thing that was apparent on that side, on the third leg, if you will, was on the left wall, there started to appear little plaques announcing just because anecdotes of different people and how they were killed and why? Allegedly, why they were killed.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Allegedly.
Right.
Let's emphasize that.
So can you remember some of those things, Heidi and Carl?
Oh, sure. Drinking, I mean, I think that's the key, is the excuse, the myriad impossibly banal, drinking from a white man's well.
Refusing to allow a white man to beat him in a fight.
Right. And these, it's not just an like Ida B. Wells found. It's not really just an accusation of rape, but that was the one everybody wanted to remember, because that's the grandest supposed excuse, right? But the reality is that it was far more trivial things that were used as an excuse to murder people, mm-hmm. and murder people in the most heinous of ways, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they don't even attempt to get at that, because you can't. But I think that's what is meaningful about the plaques, is the fact that it's those, I mean, that's what you see people taking pictures of in disbelief. You know, how could this be a reason to do what was done?
Right.
You know.
Right. So I wanted to say too.
I do have some of a tape of Carl Crawford.
Absolutely.
Reading some of these.
Wow. Benjamin Little was lynched near Mount Pleasant, Texas, in 1885 after he was accused of slandering a respectable white family. Ham Peterson was lynched in Callaway County, Missouri, in 1884 for speaking disrespectfully about some white people. This one here, Warren Powell, 14, was lynched in East Point, Georgia, 1889 for frightening a white girl.
Wow, that's just incredible. I want to go on to describe the memorial itself. People listening to the show today should know that the memorial is situated on a former slave auction site.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's some realness to that. But as you go through and end, as you're exiting the memorial, there's a sculpture there where the slaves are embedded in the sculpture and their hands are up.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was very indicative of being in a slave ship. Trying to get out.
Yes.
Trying to get out. And so that's what I picked up in this whole entire process. This is People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm here with Carl Huber, Robin Washington, and on the phone, Heidi Back Hansen. We'll be right back. Welcome back to People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Henry Banks. I'm here with Carl Huber, Robin Washington, and on the phone, Heidi Back Hansen. We all were a part of a major journey, a life-changing journey to four communities in this nation. We did stop in Memphis, Tennessee at the United States Civil Rights Museum. We can talk a little bit about that. I think that's important to share with our listeners. But I'm struck by the other museum, if I can say other museum, in Montgomery, which was the Legacy Museum on slavery and mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. When I went through that museum, the first thing I noticed on the wall was you have entered a former slave warehouse.
Right.
Which it is.
Which it is.
Which is what the building is.
Which is what the building is. I was struck by that because I immediately said to myself, there has to be a ton of other buildings around here that were the same. They operated in the same manner.
And deconstruct that word for the phrase for a second. You just said a slave warehouse.
Yes.
You know what that means? Mm-hmm. This is the ultimate of thinking of these human beings as property.
That's
absolutely
right.
Warehouse, just like you would store a bunch of logs or your old car or something.
Cattle. All over downtown.
Livestock. Wasn't it livestock, too?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That would be mingled with? Right. I mean, that just infuriated me.
Because as I learned from this, Montgomery was a major slave trading, selling market. Yeah. So people would come from all over to buy their slaves in Montgomery. So, yeah, they kept them in a warehouse before and after sale.
Yes, they did.
That leads to, in the Legacy Museum, the first exhibit you see. And if it took till the third wall for people to start crying at the memorial, there were people who were bawling at the first one.
Absolutely.
There were holographic images of women and men. What gets you immediately
children.
Children. That's right, children.
Looking
for, really, each other. The mother's saying to you, this hologram is talking to you, you're life size, normal size, and saying, do you know where my children are?
Oh, yes.
Where are my children? And you can't look at that without being affected.
No. You cannot. No.
I think there's some people who never made it beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was very difficult to go through.
There are boxes of Kleenex all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Carl, definitely. You wanted to say something on that?
It was just so powerful. The one that haunts me is the mother, where are my children? And there was inscriptions in the wall of one I can't quote directly, but it literally she had 12 children she lost, and her response is, I want to die. And I just, it chills my bones that,
The other consistent message of the entire EJIA initiative of what they do and of the two memorial and museum is it draws a straight line from slavery to lynching in the era of Jim Crow to mass incarceration.
Absolutely.
Yes. And there's a lot to read, but you can't help but read these things. Mm-hmm. And they're very well written and very well constructed. And there's no denying. Once you come out of this again, I think they've almost made a machine. Really.
Oh my God! If you really want to be educated properly about these kinds of things in our country, everybody should go to Montgomery, Alabama.
What's amazing to me is the way that they have used the technology to speak directly to you. You know, the holographic images of the enslaved people who are speaking for various folks and what their experiences are speaking directly to you. When you go to the prison where it's set up like as if you're in a visiting area of a prison in the modern day, and the prisoner talks directly to you through the telephone as if you are actually in a visiting space in a prison, and they're just being very frank,
it's not gee whiz or anything. This is real, right?
Flat out, it's just what needs to be said, and that is really, important information.
The density of information. I mean, it's a small space, and there's so much. That walk that you go, I don't know how many feet that is initially, and by the end of that, I mean, and you're tracing from. The 1600s up until the current day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one wall, but you can hardly get there.
Yeah.
And you see the images. I mean, the white boy holding the sign in the school, which I will not repeat what it said.
None of this, I think, takes away from the other Civil Rights Museum. You mentioned Memphis.
Yeah,
it's always
US
a very
Civil Rights
place.
Yes.
There's no question that you're looking at the bedroom where, Martin Luther King, with his last night on this planet.
And you're going across the street and you're looking at the space that James Earl Ray occupied.
Right.
And the window is still partly open
And just other parts of the movement. Yeah. I'm always pushing toward, as much as we revere King, there were many, many others who did stuff.
That's right.
And that's in the museum. And I was actually complaining to someone, said, well, they need more in the north. And then somebody pointed out the panel in front of me was Chicago,
which is
the movement that my family was involved in.
So, but with the U.S. Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, which was prior to us going to Montgomery, going over and stopping right in that area where the window is up, there's a plexiglass in between us. But as you go from that exhibit around the corner, there's a big banner that says something to the effect, did he do it? if he did it, did he have help doing it? And so I know the King family had said that they believe there was more to that than just James Earl Ray.
Right.
And so to have that education and that information right there in that exhibit, I thought was profound but yet important.
And it that's where's that somebody also told me what not from our delegation but somebody else said that the Civil Rights Museum was more like it was preserved in glass, and that again the EGI Museum and
very true.
Memorial were more living, interactive, and present tense. But I think actually, you know, that's the beauty of art and memorial. If you do it right, other people can add to it. So a person standing in a corner with a sign becomes part of it. You
that's
know?
Right. That's
and
right.
I'm going to go back, and I can't, you know, add enough praise to Henry and Heidi over the fact that we have a memorial in Duluth, and I
thank you, Robin.
And in the Twin Ports, people have to realize what this means. We're used to it already. Mm-hmm. It's been 15 years.
15 years.
Used to it.
Yeah.
And we're still the, I would say, the most prominent public display and acknowledgement of such a tragedy of any city in the country
and a community who that came together and did it right.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So.
Another thing about the EJI Legacy Museum, too, is the difference from probably any place I've ever been, including any memorial. Now, I don't know if they do this at any other memorials, is the absolute prohibition against cell phones and cameras.
Yes.
Yeah. You know,
yes.
That was really important in our modern day society, you know, to sort of shut that off and not try to take pictures of everything like people try to do these days, and to just experience it with no filter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was really important. And I hope they stick to that. It won't be easy, you know, as our technology improves and whatnot. But it was really, yeah, really important. We did get a photo, but we had to get special permission.
I may have gotten more, but then again, that's what journalists do.
So. right.
Well, I speak to that in terms of the reverence you move through. It creates a different tone that needs to be there, you know, because everybody is in such different places and you're in a tight space. And it challenges us to really respect that space and respect that moment and be in that moment.
That was actually something else, too. There was one point where I was interviewing one of the and I should back up and say that in addition to writing for the Marshall Project and various others, Henry and I are working on a produced documentary of the trip. And so we hope to have that to you by the Day of Remembrance this year.
Absolutely.
But we've got all this material. So at one point I was interviewing Teresa Koenig, on our delegation, and a young man from EJI came up to me and said, "Are you two together?" You're kind of wondering if it was a trick question and if you were supposed to say no, right? And when I guess he gave us a hint, and the right answer is yes, because he said there is no interviewing of strangers. Now, that being said, as we proceeded, she and I were talking about something, and somebody came up to us and added something to it. And I didn't turn off my tape recorder, and the person was perfectly fine to be quoted.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she could see the tape recorder in front of her.
Sure.
But the other part of that and the other interactive nature of the memorial is as you're looking at particularly the pillars, and as I looked at one, for instance, where my ancestors are from, Sumter County, Alabama, somebody else was looking at Sumter County, Alabama. And immediately we start talking. And I've got her number. She's got mine. She knows some Washingtons. We actually were the Balaams, part of the family that was there that I'm searching for. But, you know, we're going to connect. There were so many of these you saw. And this is just the second day, mind you, of the thing being open.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think that they've, whether on purpose or not, they've created this amazing meeting place where everyone is there for the same reason, searching for the truth, and everyone is responding to the same stimuli. And if you have any connection, you want to share that with somebody.
This is People of Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm here with Carl Huber, Robin Washington, and on the phone, Heidi Back Hansen. You know, I want to have you all talk briefly about the Duluth lynching stuff, okay? And everything that happened back in 1920. Again, as was mentioned earlier, we've actually come full circle.
We have, right?
We have absolutely come full circle as a community. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I had a wonderful conversation with Chief Mike Tuscan.
So how would you navigate the joy and the sorrow that people are experiencing today?
So that I come from it from a different perspective, as you know. I know that this has been a journey for me, knowing that I had a family member that was involved in the impetus of a lynching here in Duluth. And that journey for me was just to come to realization, how do you reconcile that? So I think this is a long process for people who've been involved in, whether they were family members involved in the lynching or friends. There's a healing that has to happen there, but then also that community, to somebody finally acknowledge or put a name to. These are people that were not forgotten. These are people that were treated absolutely with no dignity, no respect, and now they're finally having their name recognized, that they didn't die in vain, that now we have we're looking at a larger role that they're playing in now finally getting racial justice. But leaving this memorial, I think everyone has to ask themselves, what are you personally going to do to confront racism, to make sure that people have access and equality? And that really is the takeaway everyone should leave with. What are you going to do?
I thought it was remarkable that Chief Tuscan took out of his schedule to join us in Montgomery as a full circle coming together as a community event. What are your thoughts on his joining us, starting with Heidi?
I think it was important to him, obviously, and that comes from lots of conversations and him working out within himself what it means to have an ancestor. I mean, and I tell people this all the time, you know, information like that, whether you have an ancestor who may or may not have done something heinous, as heinous as participating in a lynching, chances are you would never know, because it doesn't get passed down. And Mike Tuscan didn't know until 2000. This was a family secret. Mm-hmm. So it's instead of denying that that could possibly be, I think it's important for white people to sort of recognize that perfectly normal seeming people who are lurking in your family tree may have done such a thing. And how will you reconcile that with your sense of family and, you know, belief that they are good people? You know, we don't want to think of our ancestors being bad people. And it's not really, it's about how to understand that. And it's so, I don't even, you know, how you can get through that thought process is a long journey. You know, how to recognize that could have happened. Mm-hmm. And then also understanding that that's part of you, even though you are not obviously responsible for what your ancestors do, you are still impacted by it. And that like Brian Stevenson talks a lot about the intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. That does happen even on the part of those who were present, white people who went to lynchings, witnessed horrible, heinous activities, participated in them. What does that do to them psychologically and what do they pass on through their families psychologically? I mean, obviously, historical trauma has a great impact on African heritage people, but it also has an impact on white people and how they interact in the world around them, you know, and how they use their privileges, as it were, or, you know, all the complicated ways that racism impacts people, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time. I wanted to have you all talk briefly about the meeting that we had, first time meeting for some of us, Virginia Houston. And her descendant, Elmer Jackson.
Ancestor, right.
Her ancestor, Elmer Jackson, being one of the individuals lynched in Duluth.
Well, she learned that from Warren Reed, who is a descendant of Louis Dandino, who was really the lynch mob leader. He was driving up and down Superior Street in his green truck saying, join the necktie party. And succeeded, unfortunately. And William Warren Reed found out about that by doing his ancestry. He was happily looking for, as you pointed out, Heidi, those happy relatives who all did wonderful things until he came across your article and he found out Dandino was not such a savory guy.
Louis Dandino, right. Duluth lynching.
Yeah.
That's what it said on the internet.
Right.
Yeah.
So... But, you know, he worked his way through that, as did Mike, but he points, and he ended up finding information about Elmer Jackson and actually introduced it to Virginia Houston. And they have a really warm relationship today. It's just amazing to watch. In fact, they visited the memorial and the museum together. They were all, you know. But there's one point.
But I want to say, she refers to Warren as her brother.
As my little brother.
My little brother. That's very cool. That's very cool.
And there's one more quick point that I want to quote from Warren. He points out, as hard as this has been for him, it's actually easier from him for him because he lives in Seattle. His name isn't Dandino. Half the people in Duluth don't know Dandino anyway. And so he never had to come forward. And if he didn't tell you who he was or who he was descended from, it is a direct descendant, by the way, he would, you know, he wouldn't have to. It's different for Mike. Even though Mike is not a direct, this is his great aunt.
Absolutely right.
But still, his name is Tuscan. Anyone who does know the name, it's an unusual name.
Yeah.
It stands out, and that comes to mind. And he's a policeman,
and,
let alone the police chief today.
That's right. That's right. So, we're like I said, we're just about out of time. I'm going to ask Carl if you have any additional comments you want to make, and then I'm going to have you, Heidi, close us out today.
I think the overwhelming thing for me in this was you just had to go. You just had to show up. And I know that Chief Tuscan faced a lot of challenges with what was happening back here at home. And
you mean something in Superior happened?
Is that another program? But the fact that he came speaks volumes, and it's the same thing I felt. I just had to go. I just had to show up.
Heidi?
And abide with others.
Right.
Well, I'm still processing, really, the fact that we pulled it off together, all of us. We were there together, and the meaning behind that, and as we go forward, and as we strive to be the first community to bring back our pillar, you know, for the community, I think that this is just an ongoing process, as it always has been, you know, since 2000. It's an ongoing community process. And in a lot of ways, it's a symbolic process that has more to do with, you know, the present. And I think you get through to the present goodness by going through and sifting through that history and dealing with it head on.
Absolutely. Thank you, Heidi Back Hansen, Robin Washington, and Carl Huber, for being on People of Color with Henry Banks on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have a great evening and a great weekend.
Swinging in the southern breeze. the poplar tree. Gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry. Thank you.